Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
The test cases keep piling up for Speaker of the House Mike Johnson as he continues the balancing act within his own party. Last week, it was all about FISA. Oh, yeah, and there is still this lingering question of helping out Israel and Ukraine. We get an update on everything going on in Congress this week and next from Bloomberg Government's Lauren Duggan. Lauren, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, so let's talk FISA. It was all the rage yesterday, and a lot of members of Congress giving some impassioned takes about it. Where does FISA currently stand? And, you know, maybe even just give us a brief definition of what the FISA enactment would mean this go around.
Sure. So there's this Friday, April 19th deadline to do something about parts of the FISA law, in specific Section 702, which allows the collection of, it's supposed to be outside the U.S., but can at times sweep up U.S. persons' information as well. So this is a big civil rights, civil liberties debate couched within a larger debate about national security. And what we've seen here is an issue that can divide the parties in unusual ways, where some of the most liberal and most conservative members band together, and you kind of have this tier of national security establishment people on the other side and trying to thread that needle to get this reauthorized. Law enforcement FBI Director Chris Wray would say it's hugely important to get this done, and there's been some debate about whether they can get it done by the deadline and how to thread that needle. But a big issue with many consequences.
Yeah, you said it. You know, this is one of those issues that members of whatever party love to be able to take a stand, like you said, against folks even in their own party. You know, are we looking at some of the same usual folks, the Rand Pauls and the civil liberties folks who are banding together on this fight against the Section 702?
Absolutely. Rand Paul, somebody who's done this traditionally. Years ago, he forced a debate on a Sunday, I think it was, because there was another deadline and he wanted to have a discussion on the Senate floor about this. So some of the civil liberties types you'd see on both sides of the aisle have banded together here, like I said. And, you know, even people who before might have been against it, once they get more information as a leader like Speaker Johnson, have said, well, now I have a slightly different perspective on this, given what I've known and what I've heard. So, yeah, it's a different sort of issue where, you know, party can come in. As we saw, it was Republicans who tanked the rule last week that slowed down this debate. But once they got it going again and could get the compromise to the floor, we saw some action happening.
One issue where party lines definitely do matter is the issue of the impeachment of Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas. Where does that currently stand? And is this impeachment that we've been hearing about for I don't know how long now, is it going to actually take place?
Well, we expect this week to see the House managers, the people that the House of Representatives have sent over to prosecute the case, will go over to the Senate, have their charges read, and then they will swear in the senators as a jury in a trial. The question is, will there be a trial? Some Democrats want to just dismiss it right away, but there is a large group of Republicans, I think more than, you know, almost all of them signed a letter saying we should have a trial. So there could be a lot of debate and discussion around that. Democrats, if they marshal the votes, could bring it to a pretty swift conclusion. But what Republicans have said is, if you do that, we might hold up other business and deny you unanimous consent to take up things you want to do or to move them quickly, at least. So I think we're not likely to see a long trial, if a trial at all. And these charges will likely end in dismissal because there's not 2/3 to remove him from office and convict him of the charges being sent over.
Yeah. And Mayorkas has done a pretty good job of just trying to stay out of the whole issue altogether. Has he said anything or given any inclination of how he feels about this?
I mean, I think you've said it. He was up on the Hill talking to appropriators. He's due to go up to the Hill and meet with Homeland Security Committee members this on Tuesday, I think it is, the same day they would march across and prosecute their case against him. So he's trying to do his job. He's trying to run all the things in the department and suffer, I guess he would say, the slings and arrows of what's coming at him from Capitol Hill. But, you know, I don't think the dynamic has changed. The criticisms of him from House Republicans, regardless of the trial, will remain for, you know, as long as he's in office, I would say.
One of the agencies that doesn't really make a lot of headlines will also be seeing several bills that could have an effect on the way they do business, and that's the Energy Department. What kind of legislation is up for debate now that is potentially going to affect enforcement rules for the Energy Department?
So the House is looking at taking up a number of bills this week dealing with energy efficiency standards for appliances. There's one broad bill that would remove a requirement that they do it, I think it is every 6 years, but instead, if there's a petition or something, you could redo these standards, but they would have to meet all sorts of criteria, including one that would make it really hard to ban gas stoves, which has been a debate that's come up here and there. Then there's several smaller bills that deal with individual requirements for things like washers, dryers, dishwashers, air conditioners. So taking aim at standards that could be put in place there. So it's a chance for Republicans to talk about what they see as ill-advised efficiency standards, and Democrats will probably take the opposite position and say that these are the right things to do to ensure that these appliances are better for the environment. So, you know, kind of a classic debate on those issues.
Will we hear testimony from the Maytag repairman?
He might be cited. You'll never know.
Lauren Duggan is with Bloomberg Government. And so also, Lauren, there are some other budgetary issues that are going to be taking place next week. Are there any other budget hearings that we can look forward to?
There are a lot, and this is the hearings for fiscal 2025, which starts October 1. I know we just finished the fiscal 2024 debates and in some ways are continuing them, but these, we're going to see more cabinet secretaries go up, whether it's Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack, Acting Labor Secretary Julie Sue, who's still filling in for that role while her confirmation is pending, and they will defend the budget and take questions from appropriators and authorizers on both sides of Capitol Hill. So that's really where we are with this budget season for the next year. Appropriators haven't really kicked into gear yet. That maybe we'll see that in May and once they're back from this upcoming 1 week break, but a long way to go, but this is an important early step.
And speaking of congressional fiscal decisions, there is still the lingering question of whether or not we're going to free up money for the nation of Ukraine and keep providing aid to Israel, despite some, you know, pretty troubling headlines of that have angered a few members of Congress. What is the latest as far as foreign aid goes, especially for those two nations?
There could be a push this week to do that. The Senate passed its bill several months ago now that had money for Ukraine and Israel and the Indo-Pacific. That's been frozen in the House for now. There's this discharge petition to try and break it loose, but it doesn't have the requisite majority it would need. And some of those signatures would have to come from Republicans who at this stage seem unlikely to do so. So if Speaker Johnson can thread the needle on this, I use that phrase a lot, but it's a tough path. If he can come up with some sort of package that can win enough support, maybe we'll see a vote this week before they head out for a 1 week recess that's scheduled. But if not, then we could see another week or several go without action on this. And if the House doesn't pass what the Senate did, it has to go back to the Senate and they would have to resolve that too. So we could still be a little ways away from a resolution on this question.
Yeah, you, like you said, you keep on having to use the phrase thread the needle. No real honeymoon period at all for Speaker Mike Johnson. I mean, he has been facing some tough debates, like you said, between his own party and of course with Democrats. I mean, in the historical context, has there been a speaker that has been run through the gamut as fast as Speaker Mike Johnson?
I think he's got an unusual lineage here. And of course, there's a threat hanging over his head from Marjorie Taylor Greene to possibly oust him or at least force a vote on ousting him 5 months or whatever into the job. And when we just had the first speaker ever thrown out by his own party in the middle of a Congress, as we saw with Kevin McCarthy. So it's been a really tough conference to manage, maybe even impossible at times. I'm sure it feels that way. But that's a dynamic that's been real in this very narrowly divided House with, you know, we kind of overlooked the very narrowly divided Senate, but it's a really unusual kind of time in Congress.
Lauren Duggan is Deputy News Director at Bloomberg Government. Thanks as always, Lauren.
Thank you.
And we'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com. You can subscribe to The Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions. And that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped. And I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with an intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, and work alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.